Joe Biden dismisses Tara Reid's charge. Donald Trump dismisses the Corona Task Force. And who is that unmasked man at a factory that makes the masks?
He's the Lone Ranger.
Hello, Silver! Hooray!
This week on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Will Justin Amash become this year's Ralph Nader? That's what Democrats want to know.
If Amash gets 50,000 votes or 80,000 votes in Michigan, I do think that those in Michigan, again, I do think more of those would come from the Republican side than the Democratic side. And that could flip it, right? It could be that close of an election in Michigan.
Plus, how a completely forgotten traffic stop of Martin Luther King's car in May of 1960 later affected the Kennedy-Nixon race. And we remember the Tea Party's takedown of Dick Lugar in Indiana 8 years ago this week and wonder if the days of Dick Lugar Republicans are gone forever.
Most of his causes were about foreign relations, you know, nuclear arms proliferation in Russia. So I don't think there was a great sense that he was a grassroots Republican in Indiana anymore.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 327 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Joe Biden's path to the presidency has gotten a little more complicated ever since Tara Reid, who briefly worked in his Senate office some 27 years ago, said he sexually assaulted her back in 1993. The problem here is obvious. Biden and the Democrats have been saying for a long time, even before the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court confirmation hearings, that these types of accusations by women need to be heard. For too long, men in positions of power have been sexually harassing women and getting away with it. If there's any lesson in the rise of the Me Too movement, it's that those days are over. Many of the women who came forward regarding Donald Trump or Brett Kavanaugh were not only heard, but believed. Sometimes immediately. The same people reacted differently to Tara Reid. Sometimes immediately. Last year, Reid told reporters that Biden had put his hands on her shoulders and neck and made her feel uncomfortable. But once she changed her story, things became more complicated, especially for Democrats and women's groups, those who have rallied around Biden. To make things worse, the former vice president has never quite escaped the stain of what happened during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings of 1991, when Biden, as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, seemed to dismiss Anita Hill's testimony out of hand. It took Biden longer than necessary to respond to Reid's accusations, but he finally did last Friday on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
No, it is not true. I'm saying unequivocally, it never, never happened. And it didn't. It never happened.
Republicans were having a field day with the story. But it's hard to make the case that a party that continues to defend a person who bragged about sexually grabbing women, in vulgar terms, or who paid off a porn star to keep quiet about an affair, has any moral standing on this issue. But Democrats and women's groups remain uncomfortable and uncertain. For the most part, they back Biden. He has never been accused of anything other than being a bit over the top with his shoulder rubbing. Unwanted touching, yes. A bit icky, certainly. But nothing like what Reid described. Besides, the Obama campaign vetted him completely before he was picked as VP in 2008. No doubt Republican Oppo researchers were doing the same. Certainly Donald Trump would have found something on Biden as he was searching for Barack Obama's birth certificate in Kenya. There are many inconsistencies to Reid's story. She has changed the details many times. She often praised Biden on Twitter as a fighter for women as recently as 2017. She has accused about a half a dozen other men of sexual harassment or discrimination. A lot doesn't add up. Still, unlike Trump, Biden went out of his way during his Morning Joe interview not to disparage his accuser, saying women have a right to be heard. Unlike Brett Kavanaugh, Biden didn't go into a rage and blame everything on a conspiracy by those out to get him. Remember this outburst?
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups.
But these kind of charges need to be investigated. Otherwise, they put the entire notion of Me Too into question. You can't automatically say Brett Kavanaugh is guilty while at the same time saying Joe Biden is not. You can't automatically dismiss Tara Reid when you accepted Christine Blasey Ford. Then again, do you investigate Joe Biden and not Donald Trump? These are troubling, complicated questions. Later in the program, we're going to talk about the 2012 Senate race in Indiana, where six-term Republican Dick Lugar was beaten in the primary. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last senator with at least that much experience in office as Lugar to be defeated for re-election? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com.
But first, are you experienced? Or have you ever been experienced? Well, I have.
The history of third-party and independent presidential campaigns is more likely filled with talk about which candidate gets hurt the most, rather than a serious discussion of what this third person intends to do once they reach the White House. When Justin Amash, the Republican-turned-independent-turned-libertarian congressman from Michigan, announced last month the formation of an exploratory committee to seek the presidency under the Libertarian Party banner, the questions were immediate and typical. Will he hurt Trump or Biden? How will he affect the vote in Michigan, which went to Trump by fewer than 11,000 votes 4 years ago? But before we even get there, who is Justin Amash? What are his views? And what brought him to Congress? Doug Copeman is a political science professor at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and has known Amash for many years. Professor Copeman, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Yeah, thanks. It's good to be with you today.
Oh, nobody heard of Justin Amash till he was part of that gigantic GOP wave in 2010, but unlike the guy he succeeded, Vern Ehlers, he was not a go-along kind of Republican. I mean, he made that clear from the beginning that if his party was on the wrong path, he'd let them know it, and he did.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I knew him a few years before that. He was actually born and raised in Grand Rapids, Michigan, here where Calvin University is. But he first attempted the public office in 2008. It was a state house race, a local legislative race, in which I was involved in a little bit too, although I wasn't a candidate. I participated in it, and I've participated in local politics for a long time. And few people gave him a chance in that race, and he ended up in a jungle primary, a multi-candidate primary, getting a plurality, and then getting a platform in the state house. And then 2 years later, he sort of nudged out Congressman Vern Ehlers, who was likely to retire anyway, and really recreated the same thing by a multi-candidate primary, getting a plurality and not a majority to get the Republican nomination.
What is he like, besides the kind of brand of politics that he practices? What is he like?
I think he's pretty quiet. He's very intellectual. I would say that he is a person of a particular clear set of convictions that he's always talked about. And largely they're libertarian, at least on the economic side of things. He would call himself a Christian, and because of that conviction, he is pro-life. So when issues in that realm would come for vote, most of the time he would vote on the pro-life side, but he has this prior commitment to clear and simple and non-preferential law, and it's kind of a version of libertarianism, particularly at the federal level, and that is really, it seems to be his driving matter. He doesn't much believe that members of Congress or legislatures should help local industries get government contracts, for example, or things like that. The casework that's often the bread and butter of a member of Congress, he, at least on behalf of institution businesses and things like that, he swears off for the most part because of his commitment to the libertarian principles that he has.
And it sounds like, from judging from what I've heard, you know, when I hear him speak, it sounds like he doesn't care who wins, Democrats or Republicans. He seems to lump them both together.
Yeah, it's very much part of the sort of the corrupt, you know, order, the usual order or the conventional wisdom or the two parties in power, sort of a duopoly of corruption that he talks against. And in 2010, that actually fit quite well, his first attempt for the U.S. House. That fit well, really, with the energetic faction of the Republican Party, the Tea Party faction. But his rebelliousness and going against the grain and anti-establishmentism was always a bit uncomfortable with the local Tea Party folks, because his was an intellectual approach with fixed principles that he had studied at University of Michigan and then in law school at U of M, and it wasn't a populist kind of against the system, but it was the closest candidate the Tea Party had to their own convictions. And he rode that in 2010, always a bit uncomfortable, and finally sort of this divorce around what one thought of Donald Trump, where the Tea Party folks latched onto Trump with everything they had, and Amash never really did that.
I think I read somewhere shortly after he was elected, oh no, maybe it was during the Obama presidency, but whatever it was, I read that his running for Congress was less about his dissatisfaction with Obama and more about a dissatisfaction with George Bush, George W. Bush, you know, the deficits and the surveillance and things like that.
Yeah, so Congressman Amash really has a pretty consistent libertarian view. He's very skeptical of the surveillance state, as he would call it, sort of the collecting of information and all those sorts of things that started after September 11 in response to, you know, potential terrorism attacks and those sorts of things. So President Bush and then also Obama sort of justified this growth of the federal bureaucracy to tap into conversations and monitor people's behavior. And Amash has always been very much against that, a fear of the state as much as the fear of any other bigness. So he very much was opposed to many of the things that the last Republican, George Bush, pursued in response to security concerns and domestic surveillance. And that's been pretty consistent, too, throughout his 10 years in Congress.
And another thing that's certainly consistent is that he doesn't play along well with Republican leaders. I mean, he didn't get along with Speaker John Boehner. He didn't get along with Speaker Paul Ryan. He didn't vote for Kevin McCarthy for Speaker. And then with Trump, he backed James Comey. He thought Comey was in the right when he was FBI director. He agreed with the Mueller report. He voted for impeachment. He opposed Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, and this is a member of the Republican Party.
Yeah, very much so. And I would say, at least in his personal demeanor, he's moderated a little bit in the last few years. Earlier years in Congress, he would be very vocal about his disagreement and sometimes very personal in his attacks. He thought it was unfair that he had a Republican primary opponent, I believe, in 2014. And he really went after that. After he won the primary, he kind of went after that primary opponent in pretty personal terms. To some extent, he's become more circumspect in his conversation and his demeanor and his behavior. And he's left some of the pyrogenics and some of the flair of his earlier years, but he's stayed really essentially true to the principles, as he sees them, of the libertarian movement and the libertarian view of the role of government. It's still very much the watchdog state, the limited state, at the federal level, for sure.
Well, the fact that he left the Republican Party last year, became an independent, he voted for impeachment. How does his opposition to President Trump play at home?
Yeah, I do think it's very mixed. I think in general, a lot of people understand his discomfort with Donald Trump in this congressional district and in Western Michigan in the 2016 Republican primaries. Donald Trump got third or fourth in the system. He was behind Kasich, he was behind Rubio, he was behind Cruz in some places of this district. So the mere fact that he's not a fan of President Trump would not by itself be a major problem, but he is quiet and was quite open about that. And then when the opportunity came to talk about the Mueller report and the other information that came out investigating Russia, et cetera, he's to some extent went out of his way to say that President Trump deserves an impeachment process because he's disgraced the presidential office and probably interfered in the election. So he has high standards. He has sort of very pure law-defined standards, and he was very vocal about the fact that he didn't think Trump lived up either to the law or to the decorum appropriate for the presidential office. And I think privately, a lot of people in West Michigan, I can see your point. It's a very polite part of the state. It's a very, gracious place to live. And there's a lot of discomfort with President Trump. But the reality of politics is there's really going to be two parties that control power, and you kind of have to swallow those things in order to maintain the two-party system and to maintain the basic principles of the Republican Party.
Well, that leads to my question. Could he have stayed in the GOP and fought from within?
Personally, I think he could have easily stayed in the Republican Party. And even after asserting he thought an impeachment process should go ahead, right? He didn't directly or immediately call for Trump's removal from office, but he called for an investigation, impeachment, the House side of the impeachment and removal process. I think he could have survived that if he'd wanted to. What would have happened? He already got a couple of primary opponents when he was still a Republican. He probably would have gotten three or four more, and he would have been likely to maintain a plurality in a Republican primary. But I think he felt he burned more bridges, kept burning more bridges every year, every election cycle, and every position that he took, and that he might have survived this last primary round, but he's interested in other things and interested in other offices and interested in different platforms to talk about his convictions. And getting bogged down in one more Republican primary probably wasn't all that interesting to him either.
This doesn't sound like a district that's filled with Jerry Ford Republicans. I mean, this was Ford's district, wasn't it, once upon a time?
Yeah, it is the district. I mean, the genealogy of the district, the Jerry Ford district, and, kind of a business liberal Republican, Hal Sawyer, took it over after a very brief period. There was a Democrat who served right after
Richard Vanderveen.
Yeah, Dick Vanderveen for a term.
That was a famous special election back then.
Yeah, that was the funniest special election because two Dutch people with Vanders.
Vandalan and Vanderveen.
And then it was Hal Sawyer, then it was Paul Henry, and then it was Bernie Ehlert. It was very much the moderate upper Midwest Republican that you would pretty commonly find in the 80s in Ohio and Illinois and Michigan. They're still around here, but they're pretty quiet. And yeah, the current generation and the coming generation of activists in the Republican Party are not that type. They're very much more of the both Tea Party as well as small government and populist in a variety of ways. And there are still downtown business Republicans around, but less active in party politics than they were a generation ago, that's for sure.
Well, let me ask you the inevitable question, because since he's a third-party candidate, and this is the question that every third-party candidate gets, and that is, does he affect the vote in Michigan, and who benefits and who gets hurt?
So, I think, take your pick. I personally think he could affect the Michigan vote. And I think his effect in Michigan would be different to some extent than his effect nationwide. I think in Michigan, he could easily harm Trump more than Biden, assuming that goes through. Partly because he's known for as a Republican formerly. He's pro-life still, small government at the federal level. And people got used to the name, and he's created a following in Michigan to some extent for his loud, principled, libertarian positions So there's a bit of following in Michigan. I think most of those followers are sort of still the libertarian side of the Republican Party. I do think nationwide, it's probably helps Trump and harms Biden, but it's hard to know. I mean, he has several things different from the two candidates. He's young. He has, you know, sort of firm ideas. Neither Biden nor Trump have an ideology that's really fixed, and both have records of inconsistency and inconstancy on issues. And he has Justin Amash has a pretty clear record of staying on the same side of the issues that he votes on. And it's a generational change. It's a change in energy. And I would think that nationwide, more of that new generation of leadership and throw all the bums out would probably harm Biden slightly more than it would harm Trump. I mean, you can make a really good case. Florida in 2000 was decided by people who, rather than voting for Gore or Bush, voted third party. And that, to some extent, decided the election.
Given the fact that Florida was decided by 537 votes and Nader got 97,000, I mean, in Michigan in 2016, Trump's margin over Hillary Clinton was just like under 11,000 votes. So anything that Amash gets could very well be quite significant.
Yeah, I do think, you know, if Amash gets 50,000 votes or 80,000 votes in Michigan, I do think that those in Michigan, again, I do think more of those would come from the Republican side than the Democratic side. And that could flip it, right? It could be that close of an election in Michigan.
Doug Copeman is a political science professor at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is represented in Congress by Justin Amash. Doug, thanks so much for being on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, Ken.
Last week, we focused on a horrific event that happened 50 years ago, the killing of four students by National Guardsmen at Kent State University in Ohio. It was one of the signature events of that time, and it was described by many as the moment when the war in Southeast Asia came home to America. This week, we're going to focus on an incident that happened 60 years ago, one that received very little attention at the time. To this day, it's still mostly forgotten. But in the scheme of things, it turned out to be quite significant. On May 4th, 1960, 60 years ago this week, a black man was driving a white woman in DeKalb County near Atlanta and was pulled over by the police. The man was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The woman was Lillian Smith, the novelist and fierce civil rights advocate. King was driving Smith to Emory University for her cancer treatments. Both King and Smith were well known to the police for their crusades against racism. Fast forward to September of 1960, when King paid a $25 fine for driving without a license, a bogus charge since he had a valid license with him. But unbeknownst to him, he was at the time put on probation and threatened with prison if he broke any laws, which he did shortly after. He was arrested during a sit-in at a whites-only restaurant at a department store in Atlanta. And because of the previous infraction, as contrived as it was enough for the judge to sentence King in October to 4 months, and not just in prison, to a chain gang, where the risks to his life were enormous. This was all happening shortly before the presidential race between Vice President Richard Nixon and Senator John F. Kennedy. And the rest is history. Kennedy made a personal phone call to Coretta Scott King, offering his support, and worked with the governor of Georgia, the segregationist Ernest Vandiver, to get King released. Nixon, afraid of being accused of grandstanding, did nothing. The black vote, which since the Civil War generally went to Republicans, instead went to Kennedy and has gone to Democratic presidential candidates ever since. Here to expand on that nugget of history is Cornell Brooks, the former president and CEO of the NAACP. Mr. Brooks, it's an absolute honor to have you on the Political Junkie.
It's an honor to be here, and I'm just so thankful and grateful to you for lifting up such an important, not footnote of history, but a significant chapter.
Well, it's what's fascinating to me about it, and you and I were talking shortly before we started recording, is that I had never heard of this event. Of course, we all remember, of course, we should remember the jailing of Dr. King in October of 1960 and the famous phone call and the interference by Senator Kennedy. But this traffic stop in 1960 and Lillian Smith, I mean, I had never heard of it before.
Well, the only reason that I was familiar with it is because of the biographies I've read on Dr. King. And the fact that Dr. King was driving a famous, well-noted white novelist, Lillian Smith, to cancer treatments at Emory University, that he's pulled over and given a ticket for driving without a license.
Which he had with him, by the way.
That's right, which he had with him. But he was also cited for not having a Georgia driver's license, as in a tag. But because he had applied for the license, you know, the argument was that this was completely a trumped-up charge. But the fact that Dr. King, after having been recognized for his work in Montgomery, after having been heralded around the world, was nevertheless the subject of racial profiling in 1960 for driving a white woman in his car, speaks volumes about then and now.
John Kennedy had this balancing act as well, and I'm not trying to equate the two, but Kennedy, talking about the politics of the day, you know, Kennedy still was playing footsie with John Pattersons and the Ernest Vandivers of the country, you know, the Southern segregationist white governors that he needed for the Democratic nomination and the election in November. And at the same time, he was hoping to woo black voters in November. So he was in this very odd balancing act.
Right. So John Kennedy and his brother, Robert Kennedy, were engaged in a political calculus, a calibration of a response to a real civil rights crisis in the midst of a presidential election, where before the passage of the Voting Rights Act, which took place in 1965, white conservative Democrats were an essential element of the base, particularly if you're endeavoring to be the Democratic nominee. And so he has to court white Southern Democrats, reach out to black Democrats while also contemplating the general election and contemplating the need to reach the breadth of the country. So this was a politically challenged moment, but frankly challenging relative to Dr. King's challenge, which was to lead a movement while risking his life. So while it was politically challenging for the Kennedys, it was morally and physically challenging to Dr. King and his supporters all across the country.
Oh, yeah, I won't even compare the risk to the two of them, that's for sure. But you mentioned Bobby Kennedy. At the time, Bobby Kennedy was, you know, Jack's brother. And, I mean, he was still his brother, but at the time he was Jack's campaign manager. But he thought going public and trying to get King's release in October of that year would backfire on the Democrats and cost them the White House. He was clearly wrong on that.
He was wrong on that, cautious about it, but when we look back on it in history, as it turns out, they made a decision, notwithstanding their political caution at the outset, that was morally right, historically relevant, and I would argue, historically speaking, enduring. It's my belief that the decision of the Kennedys, while begrudging, while cautious, ultimately courageous and right, that their actions then having enduring consequences today.
While this may have been, you know, politically calculating on the part of Kennedy, it was morally right, it was courageous, and it was historically significant.
That's right. And I think what's important to remember is that courage shouldn't be measured with respect to courageous action measured against initial trepidation. So in other words, while you might hesitate to take action, the fact that you do take action, demonstrate bravery, demonstrates courage, is what's important. So in other words, a soldier going into battle may hesitate at the point of entry onto the battlefield. But what people remember are sacrifices made, not initial trepidation. And so the fact that there was some political calculation, the fact there was some political fear, does not in any way diminish the fact that they did what was right and what was necessary, morally necessary to do. And the fact that a call was placed to a black woman whose husband was in the bowels of the then criminal justice system, and they were able to literally liberate Dr. King from prison, from a certain fate of death on a prison chain gang, is important and consequential. And so, you know, the fact that there was some political calculations at the outset, political fear and trepidation at the outset, does not diminish the moral legacy and the political consequence for the present moment.
You know, several years ago, there was an audio tape of Dr. King from December of 1960 that was discovered. And while King, in this tape, he said a lot of people were responsible for getting him released from jail, he did single out Kennedy.
Now, it is true that Senator Kennedy did take a specific step. He was in contact with officials in Georgia during my arrest, and he called my wife, made a personal call, and expressed his concern and said to her that he was working and trying to do something to make my release possible. His brother, who at that time was his campaign manager, also made direct contact with officials and even the judge in Georgia, so that the Kennedy family did have some part. At least they expressed a concern, and they did have some part in the release.
That's right. And I recall in terms of rendering of that tape is that Dr. King said, I'm not aware of all of the particulars and all the details, but it was important. And from the vantage point of a historical retrospective, the details are less important than the outcome.
You know, I think it's fair to say that until that moment, Kennedy's record as being a civil rights crusader, I mean, was non-existent. I mean, that was not a priority for him in the Senate or as a candidate.
That's right. In other words, I think it's important when we look at the Kennedys and we look at Martin Luther King, Edie Nixon, Abernathy, all of the figures in this morality play that we've come to understand as the civil rights movement, to understand that the characters at the time of the writing and the creation of this play were emerging, that their characters were being written by the script of history in real time. And so seeing them as fully formed, fully developed, without having rendered a conclusion as to who they are, what they stood for, what they were about, doesn't do justice to the nuance, to the texture of real people circumstantially trapped, right? In other words, people are literally bound together in a set of historical events with real consequences, real emotions, real lives on the line. And so for me, my admiration and appreciation for all of those involved, all of those who made sacrifices, grows with the fact that they were imperfect people trying to wrestle with circumstances that were being defined as they spoke, as they acted, as they contended with history.
When you think of African Americans trying to get the vote, you think of fire hoses and police dogs and Bull Connor and things like that. But now it's in this day, it's a little more subtle, or it's a lot more subtle. It's vote suppression, you know, the kind of things that they put up in rules that to make it more and more difficult, if not discouraging the vote completely. And I wonder, given the fact that vote suppression has been a way of life, or at least it's not a new form of racism, but the fact that we're in the midst of this virus pandemic And there's going to be so many efforts. I just wonder if they were going to be so focused on the pandemic that there will be more efforts made to suppress the vote, and nobody, and maybe the nation will be too preoccupied to notice.
Well, that might have been the case, but for the visual of people standing in line waiting to cast their ballot outside of decreased number of voting precincts on socially distanced in Wisconsin.
On April 7th.
That's right. The fact that we had people voting in the midst of a pandemic, risking their lives in order to cast their votes, is a reminder that in the last presidential election, black votes were purged. And the number of black votes purged in Milwaukee alone was the margin of victory for our president, Donald John Trump. After the 15th Amendment was enacted, granting African Americans the right to vote, after the 14th Amendment recognized African Americans as citizens of the U.S., voter suppression began immediately. So in other words, voter suppression then was the use of poll taxes. Voter suppression then was the use of racial terrorism. Today, voter suppression looks like voter ID laws. Voter suppression looks like decreased number of polling places. Voter suppression looks like compelling people to vote in the middle of a pandemic. Voter suppression looks like the absence of vote by mail, where we have vote by mail in a handful of states and vote by mail in nearly every state, if not all states, where we call it absentee voting. Where we have the president say, literally say, we can't have vote by mail because it will advantage Democrats, disproportionately African Americans, as opposed to Republicans, disproportionately white Americans. That says everything you need to know about the reality of voter suppression in 2020. Ask Stacey Abrams, who literally saw the Secretary of State, who was running for governor, namely Brian Kemp, purge black votes literally as though they were going out of style. And he then becomes governor. So I do want to note that it's not just an enthusiasm gap, it's a voter suppression gap. Now, with respect to your question directly, and going into the fall election, I would just simply say this. Having served as president of the nation's largest civil rights organization in the last presidential election, what I saw was an insufficient attention and focus on voter suppression. What I saw was an insufficient investment in grassroots mobilization. So in other words, I am simply saying, notwithstanding the many efforts that were made, insufficient investment was made in terms of turning out the vote at a grassroots level. So for those who in the Democratic Party who are investing in consultants and pollsters and this, that, and the other thing, unless you want to repeat what you saw in 2016, I would strongly suggest that you invest in black-led organizations, black-led efforts. But not only that, invest in youth-led efforts. Invest in Latino-led efforts, Native American-led efforts. Invest in grassroots organizations across the board. Why? Because it's important to gin up enthusiasm. It's not just about who's up or down in the latest polls. You have to make sure, just as you've suggested here, that the people are enthusiastic about the candidate and willing to turn out the vote en masse and in the millions, particularly in the midst of a pandemic. So if you think that you can just give resources to those who give you all the reassuring answers that they've long given you and think you're going to make your way to the White House with a president who's willing to suppress the vote, don't be mistaken. Don't be naive. That needs to be said bluntly, clearly, and without equivocation.
Cornell Brooks is the former president and CEO of the NAACP. He's currently a professor of public leadership and social justice at Harvard University. Professor Brooks, thank you so much for your time.
I'm so delighted to be on the podcast, and thank you. Thank you for lifting up this important chapter of history and for the work that you did. Thank you.
Courage, don't you dare fail me now. I need you to keep away the doubts. I'm staring in the face of something new. You're all I got to hold on to. dare fill me now.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last sitting member of the House who gave up his or her seat to run for president as a third-party candidate? The answer, John Anderson. A Republican congressman from Illinois, he decided in April of 1980 to end his bid for the GOP nomination and run as an independent. In doing so, he gave up his seat in the House. And the randomly selected winner is Dan McGrath of Clifton Springs, New York. Dan wins the coveted Political Junkie button. And don't forget, you can always find our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Give it up, you can't win, because I know where you've been. Such a shame you don't put up a fight. That's a game that we play at the end of the night. It's the same old story, but you never get it right. Give it up. It's time for This Week in Political History. Dick Lugar was the most prolific vote-getter in Indiana history. A former mayor of Indianapolis, the Hoosier Republican broke the state record when he was elected to a fourth Senate term in 1994. In 2006, when he won his sixth term, he ran with no Democratic opposition. But things were different in 2012. The Tea Party was in full swing, angry with President Obama and the Democrats. They were angry with Senator Lugar, who supported overhauling the nation's immigration system. He supported the DREAM Act. He voted for Obama's Supreme Court nominees. He backed the president's nuclear proliferation policies. And they came up with a challenger, Richard Murdoch, the two-term state treasurer. And they threw everything at Lugar.
This is a missing senator alert. Senator Richard Lugar has not been in Madison since 2002. That's over 100 months, folks. Yet he wants to return to Washington, D.C. Things have gotten so bad that even when Lugar comes back to Indiana, he stays in a hotel. Lugar used to be Nixon's favorite mayor. Now he's Barack Obama's favorite Republican. Photos of Lugar appeared in campaign ads that helped Obama win Indiana. Lugar voted for the three most liberal justices on the Supreme Court. He has voted to increase the gasoline tax, increase Social Security taxes. He voted for a Democrat cap and trade scheme, voted against cutting the federal budget, and will not sign the Taxpayer Protection Pledge. Gun owners of America give Lugar a lifetime rating of F. The NRA gives him a D+. Lugar has been in D.C. too long. We need to defeat Obama and his regime in 2012. We also need to help Richard Lugar retire.
And it worked. Murdoch won in a landslide.
This race is not about animosity. It's about ideas. It is about the direction of the Republican Party. It is about the direction of our country. Yeah. Hoosier Republicans want to see the Republicans inside the United States Senate take a more conservative track, and we're looking forward to helping do that.
Lugar, in defeat, was philosophical.
We are experiencing deep political divisions in our society right now. And these divisions have stalemated progress in critical areas. But these divisions are not insurmountable. And I believe that people of goodwill, regardless of party, can work together for the benefit of our country.
How did Dick Lugar go from running unopposed to losing his own primary 6 years later? Chris Sikich is a political reporter with the Indianapolis Star who covered that primary in 2012. Chris, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Well, describe, if you will, the kind of respect people of both parties had for Dick Lugar.
Yeah, Dick Lugar was one of those candidates that transcended politics. It was pretty usual for both Democrats and Republicans to vote for him throughout the years, whether he had a candidate or not. For decades, he was the epitome of what Hoosiers thought a politician should be in Indiana. And so it came as a little bit of a surprise when the Tea Party targeted him and we found out that he was vulnerable.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is that, I mean, aside from the fact that, you know, he was famously once known as Richard Nixon's favorite mayor, but he was considered a conservative. I mean, for the most part, he was a conservative Republican when he ran for president in 1995. Didn't last long, but when he ran, he was running on conservative principles. And yet, You know, with, I guess, with Obama in the White House and a Tea Party insurgency and Lugar sounding more and more moderate, plus the fact that he no longer lived in the state, his standing suddenly seemed shaky.
Sure. He was, I think he was still conservative in the 2000s, but there just wasn't room for compromise anymore. That was the beginning of the era we find ourselves in now. And a lot of his votes you'd consider to be conservative stances on Russia and things of that nature. But anytime you side with Obama or Obama sides with you, it's going to look bad along that Tea Party crowd.
And I guess by not having to campaign in 2006, when he ran unopposed, his political skills had to have gotten rusty.
I think that was his big mistake, is he stopped visiting Indiana regularly. He almost felt like a national politician and not a local politician. So he wasn't somebody that you had on speed dial in Indiana anymore. And most of his causes were about foreign relations, you know, nuclear arms proliferation in Russia. So I don't think there was a great sense that he was a grassroots Republican in Indiana anymore. When he came back to campaign, you could tell he was really rusty at it. And his age started to show. The guy was 82 at that point, and so he didn't sound terribly charismatic. He didn't sound terribly in tune with the times. You could definitely tell that he was an 82-year-old guy. And I think, aside from just the Tea Party concerns, a lot of other Republicans just thought it was time for him to have picked a successor to back. And it was time for him to maybe ride off into the sunset with an endorsement from a more moderate candidate.
Although I think it's fair to say that Lugar and charisma never went hand in hand, did it?
That's true. He wasn't always the most charismatic guy, was he?
But he was a decent guy, that's for sure. So tell me, who was Richard Murdoch?
Richard Murdoch was a two-term state treasurer. He was fairly unknown, probably more of a generic Republican at the time. His name had been on the ballot for things like congressmen over the years, but the Tea Party really grabbed onto him, and he was pretty far right on every stance you'd want to be on. And he didn't really speak to bipartisanship and wanting to work out deals with Democrats. His idea was to go to Washington and bend Democrats to his will.
Well, I was watching a Tea Party forum the other night from 2010 when Murdoch was seeking re-election as state treasurer, and I found this kind of interesting.
Our current state treasurer is Republican Richard Murdoch. All right, our next candidate for state treasurer is Democrat Pete Buttigieg.
Pete Buttigieg, I mean, the name, we know who he is now, but then did anybody know? I mean, I know he was a Democrat running for state treasurer, but did anybody know who Pete Buttigieg was in 2010?
Yeah, in 2010, Pete Buttigieg was a 28-year-old college graduate who put his name on the ballot to beef up his standing among the Democratic faithful. The Indiana treasurer seat has remained in Republican hands since the 1970s. It's just, this is still a really red state. Every once in a while, a Democrat can jump up and win something for governor, if there's a big issue and it's a good candidate. But those generic state seats, those always go to the Republicans, or nearly always. So Buttigieg was just putting his name on the ballot, getting out there. And he did parlay that into a successful two-term run in South Bend. So it worked for him. But Pete Buttigieg isn't really even the type of candidate that can win in Indiana. At least I don't think so. Our Democrats tend to be like maybe Republicans in New York and California, where they're anti-abortion, they're pro-guns.
Well, okay, so back to Murdoch. So he was elected twice statewide. He was about 20 years younger than Lugar. And so, I mean, we were listening, you and I were listing all the things that were not in Lugar's favor. But having pointed all that out, is there something that Lugar could have done differently to win that primary?
I think it would have had to have started years before. He would have had to have really been visiting Indiana, during his last two terms in order to pull that out. And even then, it just might have been his time. He was still going to be the, moderate Republican, and that Tea Party was ready for something different. And this is Trump country here in Indiana today, and the Tea Party was a precursor to that. So you were just seeing the beginning of what a lot of Republicans in Indiana want to see from their candidates.
Well, Murdoch was known for two things that year. He beating Lugar in the primary, as we said, And then he said this during a debate against his Democratic opponent in the fall when he was asked about allowing abortions in the event of rape or incest.
Life is that gift from God, and I think even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, that it is something that God intended to happen.
Chris, he never recovered from that, did he?
He never recovered. Donnelly might have beat him anyway. Enough Lugar Republicans were going to stay home because they were mad.
You're talking about Joe Donnelly, the Democratic candidate.
Joe Donnelly, the Democratic candidate. And he's one of those that I spoke of earlier. He anti-abortion, pro-guns, very conservative Democrat. And so, moderate Republicans mad at Murdoch and mad at the Tea Party might have either stayed home or voted for Joe Donnelly. But once the rape comment hit, boy, I remember watching that debate, and he said that, and it was just a jaw-dropper. Like, everything changed at that moment, and he never recovered. Donnelly didn't have to do much after that other than show up at the debates and keep his name on the ballot, and that race was over.
From what you know about Dick Lugar and what you know about the Republican Party, can you imagine Lugar? You're talking about how it's really a Trump party, today. Could you imagine Dick Lugar ever winning a GOP primary in Indiana in this day and age?
I think a young Dick Lugar might have, not unlike a Todd Young, guy who can speak to bipartisanship. And there's a chance he would have won. And then I do think he would have beat Joe Donnelly that year, by the way. Donnelly only put his name on the ballot because the Republicans gerrymandered his congressional seat. So it was either lose his congressional seat or lose the Senate seat to Richard Lugar. And I guess if you're going to go for it, you might as well go for it. So
never expecting that he'd run against Richard Murdoch.
Yeah, never expecting that. So one day Donnelly woke up and it went from just being, let's get my name on the ballot one more time and then go figure out what I'm going to do to, wow, I might win a Senate seat here.
So and what about the Democrats as well? I remember the days. I love talking about how old I am, but I remember the days when Indiana had Democrats like Birchbaugh and Vance Hartke in the Senate. And actually, I don't even have to go back that far. Evan Bayh was not that long ago. And we know that we know why Joe Donnelly won. But anyway, but those days of electing Democrats, especially to the Senate, they seem like a million years ago.
I can't imagine a scenario now where a Democrat wins a statewide race in Indiana. I guess if the economy worsens and coronavirus worsens, something could happen. But what you see at play here is Democrats used to be able to put together a coalition for the big races of African-Americans in Indianapolis, steel workers along Lake Michigan outside Chicago. And then, and this is what's changed, the coal mines in southern Indiana, the white working class, high school educated voters down there used to vote Democrat sometimes. They'd vote for the Richard Donnellys, for the auditor and the treasurer and all that stuff. But if an Evan Bayh popped up, they'd go with him. Democrats had to be from the southern part of the state for the most part to win a statewide office here, whether it's Evan Bayh or the governor who followed him, Frank O'Bannon. But as Trump has really harnessed that anger from white working class voters, those folks south of Indianapolis, and that's 2 hours south of Indianapolis, it's a long state, are all Republicans now. And I don't know that there's anything the Democrat Party is going to do to get those folks back. So now all the Democrats can really get into is the African Americans in Indianapolis.
And Gary.
Yeah, and then the steel workers up by northwest Indiana. And then the African Americans in Gary, you're right, but then the steel workers in that area too. So it's just really tough to win a statewide race now for Democrats.
Chris Sikich is a political reporter with the Indianapolis Star. Chris, it was great having you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
It was 8 years ago this week on May 8th, 2012, when Dick Lugar, a former presidential hopeful and the longest serving senator in the history of Indiana, was defeated in the Republican primary by Richard Murdoch in a bid for a seventh term. Murdoch would go on to lose the seat to the Democrats in November. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
It's been a long time, now I'm coming back home. I've been away now, oh how I've been alone.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
I feel as though you ought to know that I've been good as I can be. And if you do, I'll trust in you and know that you will wait for me. But if your heart breaks, don't wait, turn me away. And if your heart's